Welcome to By the Well. I'm Robin Whittaker, and Fran Barber, my co-host, is away on some well-deserved leave. So stepping into her chair, so to speak, for the next couple of weeks is our friend and colleague, Kylie Crabb. Hi, Kylie.
Hello. Great to be here.
Thank you for stepping in like this. For our listeners who don't know who you are, tell us a little about yourself.
Sure. I'm a minister in the Uniting Church in Australia, and I'm a New Testament scholar. I work as a senior research fellow at Australian Catholic University in Melbourne, and work on various bits and pieces kinds of things, often on Luke and Acts or other parts of the New Testament. And at the moment, I'm particularly working on a project to do with disability in early Christian literature. So, a range of things, fun stuff. Yes. And I'm really excited to talk about these texts today. It's great.
Yes, we've got some meaty texts. And we should just say to listeners, we're sorry, we're still in lockdown here in Melbourne. So we're using Zoom. The sound quality isn't quite as good as usual, but hopefully you can still hear us.
So today we're in the 19th Sunday after Pentecost, and the readings we'll be covering in this podcast are Exodus 32 verses 1 to 14 and Matthew 22, 1 to 14.
So Kylie, let's begin with the gospel reading with Matthew 22. Give us some context. What's going on here in Matthew? Where are we up to?
Yeah, fab. You may have been following on the readings through Matthew in recent weeks. So this is a parable that we have today. You may know it as the parable of the wedding banquet or something like this. And it follows on from a couple of other parables that were talked about last week, parable of the two sons and of the wicked tenants. So there are actually quite a few little connections of words and ideas across these texts.
Yeah, and they're all parables about the kingdom or the kingdom of heaven, yes, which is Matthew's preferred way to talk about the kingdom, not kingdom of God. Do we find this parable anywhere else?
Yes, yeah, we do. And I think this is a funny thing about it, encountering it in Matthew. This may just be that I spend more time in Luke, but I think I'm not alone in finding this parable to be a bit odd in Matthew. It's more familiar to us in Luke, the way that it kind of follows on this kind of long story that is also set at a banquet and has different kind of banquet sort of like mini parable bits in Luke 14, where we have the stuff about where you sit, being careful where you sit at a dinner party, sitting in the seat of honor or not, and being pushed forward or up depending on where you boldly sit to begin with. And then the story about going out and bringing in the poor, the blind, and the crippled and the lame, into the wedding banquet. So we have that in Luke, and we also have a version of it in the Gospel of Thomas, which people may or may not know about, but is a gospel that, of course, isn't in our New Testament in the canon, but is sort of a series of sayings. Probably been different views on this, but probably a bit later than our canonical gospels. But there is a sort of version of this story that is a bit similar, probably to the Lucan one more than to the one in Matthew.
Interesting.
Yeah, but what did you think though, Robin? Did you find some bits that feel a bit strange in Matthew when you're used to the other versions?
Yes, because I think Luke's is possibly a little bit more palatable in some ways because it feels like this welcoming in of lots of people. Matthew's is, I mean, we're in a part of Matthew and it's going to get worse before it gets better, where there's lots of images of judgment.
Yeah.
So I think I want to say we need to read Matthew's on his own terms. And depending on what you think the relationship between the Gospels are, I would tend towards the view that Matthew's is the earliest and, if anything, Luke has Matthew and has adapted it.
Yeah.
But that's a whole controversial.
There's a question there, right? And whether it might be that there are, even from really early on in church tradition, people noticed how different these stories were and started to wonder if they were different kind of stories that Jesus told at different times. And even if people don't think that now, then to think maybe there might be a common tradition behind them. I'm also of your kind of view where I might be leaning towards thinking that Luke used Matthew rather than that they have some common source that we might have thought about as Q or something that, if people have heard of that. But I probably don't want to read too much into it, but it would mean that Luke actually got rid of some of the awkward judgy bits that we find in Matthew. Yes. It did go in that direction.
That's right.
Although it still has, you know, none of those who were originally invited will taste my supper in Luke. So it's not entirely without its sharp edge.
No, not at all. So should we get into some exegetical nitty gritty here?
Let's do it. Everybody loves a bit of exegetical nitty gritty, I'm sure.
You've got two New Testament scholars here. We're going to get into exegetical. So when I just reread this in Greek to prepare for it, I was really struck by Jesus sets up the story, the kingdom of heaven may be compared to, and in Greek it says a human king. It's very clear it's being, or a king who is a human. So that was one thing that struck me. And it struck me because I think we mustn't just go straight to this king is God.
Yeah,
he's very clearly saying the kingdom of heaven is like a human king and let's work with that image for a while.
Yeah, great. So it can be so tempting, right, to look at a parable and go, oh, this is obviously this character's this, this event means this. And there has been loads of debate in New Testament scholarship about how to read parables, and some of them are a bit different from other ones. But to not just jump into assuming that each thing has an analogue, and especially these kind of like bizarre characters like this king character, to think maybe it's not God. It might be making a different point.
Yes, and if it's a human king, I don't want to jump ahead too much, but it gives us the freedom to say, is even the king behaving ethically? Like we don't have to defend the king's actions as just, and we can kind of throw the whole parable open. But what else did you notice?
Yeah, fantastic. What else did I notice? I noticed a few things. Let me think. One of them is that we noticed kind of maybe right from early on. You'll see in your English translations that it always says servant. You sent the servants out to do something, but actually they're douloi. They're slaves. And so, not to make a huge other point in terms of the story about that, but to just remind us how different this world is and to not kind of paper over the cracks here and think that, they are assuming slavery in this story. That's part of the world and what's happening.
It's normal.
Yeah. And by the time we get to the end of the story, actually, we do have someone who is a servant, a steward, really, which is where our word for deacon comes from.
Yeah, diakonos.
Yeah, exactly. So they're the ones who end up being the bouncers to send the person out who doesn't have the right.
Yeah, balance. In verse 13 there. Yeah.
Speaking of jumping ahead with the story. Yeah. One thing I would also say, and I'll switch then to you for other ideas. One thing I noticed was that when they first the slaves first go and invite the people who've already been invited, because you do like a couple of rounds of invites in a Greco-Roman banquet. So you've got your round of invites, so you're waiting for the next, everything's ready, come on in. They just, I can't remember what the NRSV says. It says something that they didn't come or something. But here it says that they don't want to. They say that they just don't want to come, so they're not interested.
Yeah, the NRSV has they make light of it, but actually the Greek is clearer that they're just not interested.
Yes.
they just don't want to be there, which is one of the absurd parts of the story, right? If we get an invitation from royalty or the prime minister or whatever to come to their child's wedding, it's an honour. And so to just be like, oh, no, I've got to, muck out the stables on my farm today seems like a ridiculous response. And that's one of the first parts of this that is kind of the shocking. Let's not skip over it.
Yeah. So you think it's meant to sort of trip the audience up a bit. You're like, hang on, this isn't what's meant to happen.
Yeah. Well, because you just referred to Greco-Roman banquets. I mean, this is relying on a whole lot of assumed cultural things around how weddings work, how benefaction works with the power play of a king and who would send slaves. And so then there's a number of points where people behave in the most absurd way. And one of them is to simply ignore the invitation. And the second one, to jump ahead, is second round, is to actually kill the people who bring the invitation. That is...
getting a bit over the top here.
Yeah. I mean, that is just absurd, and there's no reason given. It's absolutely illogical that you would even do that.
Yeah. So there's a thing, right, about the genre of this, like these parables, they're telling us this over-the-top stuff. It's not necessarily meant to be like, like to begin a story with, this is a story that is a bit like XYZ. Yep. It's giving you prompts. It's like when you read Once Upon a Time, that this is going to be a story that is not just like a kind of historical narrative, right?
Yes, exactly. And we need to be, I mean, there's lots of parables, and Amy Jill Levine's work on parables is great for pointing out. We've tended to domesticate them, and particularly when we assume it's about God and God's followers.
Yeah.
And we go, oh, okay, but actually they would have shocked, they would have had twists, they would have sometimes been funny.
Yeah, yeah.
So how do we play with these images to kind of maybe even make them a bit more contemporary to try and get some of that shock value in?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So, and so if it's shocking that the second round of invites leads to, you know, people being seized and killed, how bizarre is the next bit where the king then just burns down the city?
Exactly. Like just a measured response, not at all.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, so you could say there's an addressing of justice, but actually this king behaves in a over-the-top, again, an over-the-top response to something going on. And then that next round, the go out and gather from the roadways, this is another one of those exegetical points. The people gathered in are both good and bad, but the Greek has evil. It's poneros.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So the good and the evil are gathered into this banquet.
Yeah. Yeah,
I don't really know what to make of that, but
Well, totally. And then that it kind of, and some people would say that this use, I mean, it is interesting that it uses the word evil rather than just bad. There's there's a different word that could have been used for that, but that's not what they've gone for. But some people say that it sets up the next bit so that it shows you that everybody who's then in the full banquet towards the end of the parable is not necessarily, this is not, the story is not yet over. There's there's going to be some other point of tension or kind of conflict in the story that still needs to be resolved, which is what we then get, right?
Yep.
So do we cut to that? Is there more on that? No. Shall we cut to that then? So we get this bizarre thing where the next round is like, so all these people that were meant to be here, they're not calm. It doesn't have the nice long, the nice sort of like list that we get in Luke of how they reject it and then they go away to their different places. But it does have someone who's needs to go to a farm and someone who needs to deal with a business. Yeah, so they all say no. Then we get this next round that goes to everybody, and it says to go to like the edges of the roads and bring them all in. So and then it's the evil and the good. And we get in there, and then there's this issue with this person who's not in the right clothes.
Yes.
Any thoughts on being in the right clothes when you've just been dragged in from the edge of the roads?
Well, I mean, So again, I think this is another one of those moments we're supposed to sit up and pay attention, because he's addressed as friend. So you think, oh, how lovely, the king's come over, friend, you know, you're not wearing the right clothes. Is he going to be given the right clothes? No, he's going to be thrown out bound
in
the outer darkness with weeping and gnashing of teeth.
But this is one of the things that I wondered about, though, because it was like, it seems like there isn't a kind of like hostile response. Well, it depends how you take this, like friend, how did you get in? How did you get in in that outfit kind of thing?
Yes.
Which, I mean, could just sound like a kind of mean girl response about, like, how did you get here in that?
Yeah, that's
right. But there's something going on there.
Yeah.
But then there's this kind of, there's this moment where, I don't know, when I read it through in the Greek, I was like, could something else have happened here? Like we have this thing where then the person, it says, and it says it in the passive, he's silenced.
Yes.
Silence. Who's silencing this guy? Is it the question from the king and he just kind of like fails to respond? Was there an opportunity there where he could have said, man, I was so pleased to get the invite that I didn't like stop for a change of outfit, you know, pass go. I just went straight here. And that's because I'm so pleased to have me, for you to have me. Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks for being here. I'm really enjoying it. And could the story have ended differently? Like, or is it that, you know, there's something else going on and this guy who's in the wrong outfit was never going to kind of step up to the plate or however we think of it. But then it gets super harsh. It uses the language that Matthew uses elsewhere, being cast into the outer darkness when he's been, having already been bound by foot and hand.
Yeah.
I had a question about whether there really was two stages in the interaction with the king there, or if it was already kind of setting up for this kind of eviction. Not sure.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't really know, but my sense is if we let the parable as a whole kind of wash over us, it goes to what you were saying earlier about, you know, we've got these different groups of people called, but none of them quite get it right.
Yes.
You know, and it does remind me of last week's parable with the two sons where, you know, there's the son who says, yes, I'll do it, but doesn't. and the other one who says no but does do the right thing. And we tend to think, oh, well, you know, that one's come good. But in fact, neither of them get it right. And so there's part of me that wonders if these Kingdom of Heaven parables in this part of Matthew are, I mean, in their context, it's definitely designed as part of the conflict between Jesus and the other Jewish leaders. So there is a polemic to it. But at the end of the day, no one gets it right. So there's also a general warning, even to Matthew's community or to non-Jewish leaders, that you might think you're in, but actually no one comes into the Kingdom of Heaven perfect or, or free of divine judgment. Now, I don't know whether we need to look further for where the good news and the grace is in that. And it's probably in the everyone being gathered in and given the opportunity. But there's – so I guess the parable invited me in thinking how you might preach on this if we turn to that. You know, I wonder if no one in this parable actually behaves well, including the king. And therefore we're supposed to see it as, I don't know if it's supposed to be irony or whether it's supposed to just invite us to think, well, what would a good king look like and what would an appropriate response be? And an appropriate response at least would be to welcome the invitation and to come prepared. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, and totally. And it makes me wonder about, and on the one level, like we're saying, it's a kind of unreasonable kind of preparation. The example of the clothing is unreasonable in this context about that being the appropriate kind of preparation. But maybe it does prompt us to wonder, like, what is the right kind of preparation in this kind of setting? I do think it's interesting that there's these two stages and that they're even in the second stage when the banquet, we're told that the wedding is full, even then it includes the evil, which, you know, like is in there. So it still is some kind of, I mean, I guess there are multiple ways of looking at that. It could feel scary or it could feel hospitable, that it's like that everybody is still in there. Despite the sharpness of the final conversation there. And we do get this like bizarre final verse, which, you know, the many are called but few are chosen, which perhaps is meant to be showing this kind of winnowing thing. You know, it's like a bit like the wheat and the chaff. It's like showing this kind of thing. But, I mean, I noticed that partly there's a kind of quirky thing in the Greek there where it all kind of like rhymes sort of. It's kind of alliterative.
Yeah, you've got some alliteration going on.
Yeah, it's good. You've got the many are kletoi, but few are eklektoi.
Yep.
So you can hear then, even if you don't know the Greek, you can hear how there's this kind of repetition in that sound.
Yep.
And that it is a funny, these are funny words to be using anyway, because they also kind of riff a bit on the way that the word to be called to an invitation works, and the invited, which has been used all through the story as well. So I don't know. I mean, that kind of verse I think can be used in a really scary way sometimes in churches. And I'm not sure that the story is, I mean, there's scary bits to it, definitely. Like there are, like you're saying, throughout this section of Matthew building up a bit. But I wonder if it's actually, it actually could be a more encouraging, hospitable thing if we were to focus on the side of it that is like many are called.
Yes.
And to think about that and to think about like Matthew's audience. I don't know what you think about what their situation might be, but certainly, you know, it's not necessarily intended for an audience who would identify with the people who said, oh, I've got to go check out my farm or I've got some work on my business. So I don't know. What do you reckon, Robin, about where do you sit in the story? Where does the reader now sit in the story?
Well, yeah, and I think that's a great question because it probably depends who is hearing this. And I think we're invited into it at several points. And picking up that last one, you know, what does it mean if we think of the church as attempting to embody the kingdom in some ways? That, you know, many are called and they come in a variety of ways but might not be dressed. We take this as a metaphor. Their faith might not look like the kind of faith we expect them to have. They might not behave in the ways that we think a Christian behaves. Mm. And are there ways that we're like the human king in casting them out? So I think it invites us to think about who we are in the parable without being too rigid in our allegory, but I think it invites. And but I think we can't get away from the word of warning here. So maybe there's also a, I want to say there's a pastoral word for or challenge to us to how we treat the person who might feel they sit in church every week and not know, not feel like they deserve to be there.
Yeah.
So it might make us aware of that person. But also it's a word of warning, I think, to those of us who sit there too easily and think we've got it all sorted out or we don't have to keep working on our faith. And in fact, there's a word of judgment here that says don't rest on your laurels too much.
Yeah. And there's something to, I totally resonate with all of that. And I think it's really helpful, especially in prepping for preaching, to imagine, you know, like what is there in what I'm saying today for the person who's like just making it through the week, which is plenty of people during lockdown and stuff. So what is there in that, in what I'm saying for that person? And the person I'm thinking of when you describe that, that is the person who's sitting there week after week thinking, I don't know that I belong, or I don't know if I've got the right, got my stuff together right, or, you know, whatnot. Yeah. And so to kind of like, and to keep that alongside that sense of challenge. I guess the other part of it is to think of this as being, this is a kind of, you know, it's a somewhat traditional setting for a story like this, this idea of a banquet, not just a banquet, but a wedding banquet. Mm. And so we get also in our biblical texts other examples of this as an eschatological banquet.
Yeah.
But I don't know, I guess part of what I'm struck by in, when you say about like us as the behaving like the king, is on what authority do we throw someone out partway through the party? Like it's not the end of the conversation yet. So actually all of the evil and the good are meant to be all in here, and we might all be somewhere on that spectrum really. So how we make it a place of hospitality as well as challenge.
No, I agree. I think we need to turn to Exodus, however, because we're running out of time. For those who might preach on the Philippians 4 passage for this week, just a reminder, I recorded a podcast with Sean Winter, who's a Philippians scholar. That's episode A145, and you can listen to us talk about Philippians there.
Yeah, good. And so turning to Exodus then, Robin, can you fill us in a bit on where are we at in Exodus? It's a big jump from where we were at kind of last time we looked at Exodus in the lectionary. So what's happened and what's going on?
Yeah, we've jumped forward 12 chapters from the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20. And now we're still at Sinai, but there's been a lot of law narrated and given in between, including instructions, which I think this is quite important for understanding liturgically, what's going on here, including instructions for building the tabernacle where God will live and that there'll be an altar and priests will be consecrated. And we're going to see that immediately twisted in this passage.
Speaking of nobody quite getting it right in some of our stories, there's going to be a little bit more of not quite getting it right.
Exactly. But I want to suggest that I think we think of this as a story of idolatry, but I'm not sure it's quite that obvious. Is my first point. And I think too, just picking up the Matthew thread, I do quite like this pairing in the lectionary because so many in the church still live with that heresy that the God of the Old Testament is judgmental and wrathful and the God of the New Testament is all love and rainbows. And here we have a God who forgives, which is actually
in the Hebrew text.
In the Hebrew text. So let's just remember that.
Yeah, that's good. Good.
But Moses has been up the mountain for 40 days and nights. So it's our passage starts with Moses lagged, is Robert Alter's translation. Moses lagged in coming down from the mountain. And so the people are worried, you know. And Aaron is a funny character because he's the people pleaser in the story. They say, come, we want to make gods. And he's just like, well, give me your jewelry. And then later on when he retells the story, which is beyond our passage in the lectionary, retells the story to Moses, he's kind of like, I threw the gold into the fire and out came a calf. Like, I didn't really have too much to do with it. It just kind of happened.
Yeah.
So, again, it's a funny story. But Yeah, let me just say, I think the ambiguity in it comes in verses 4 and 5, where they make the golden calf. But I think Aaron here plays an interesting role because, and the NRSV probably has in verse 4, "These are your gods, O Israel." But we could also translate this as, "This is your God," because the Elohim is usually translated as singular for God.
Yes.
"Who brought you up from the land of Egypt." So the God who brought you up from the land of Egypt will be repeated about 5 times in different people's mouths in this passage. That is the core identity of God. And Aaron is actually connecting that God to this golden calf. A number of Old Testament scholars now talk about the sin here is not idolatry, that they made an image of another god. The sin is that they tried to make an image of their God who brought them out of Egypt, an image of Yahweh, because Aaron will then say again in verse 6, as he builds an altar in front of this golden calf, "Tomorrow is a festival to the Lord." And when you see the capital L-O-R-D, Lord, it's Yahweh in the Hebrew.
Yeah.
So this is a festival for Yahweh. He's still making that connection to Yahweh, even with a golden calf. So they've broken the second commandment, not the first.
Yes. But
what we do with that is still a question for preaching.
I'm encouraged by that, with the idea though that we don't just jump straight into it being easy to kind of dismiss, "Oh, it's just about idolatry." We know how that works. We've got some nice stuff in Pauline literature too that is about stuff to do with idolatry. You know, we're going to just like switch over with that.
Yeah.
But in fact, it is about something. I mean, the place that I go to there is that, is it makes me think about what are the ways in which we can be, we can sort of slide into ways of describing or imaging God that are kind of similarly like reductive or misleading about the nature of God, and we can become, can become like that. Certain kinds of, don't want to get too specific necessarily, but, you know, when we get too hooked into particular kinds of terms or liturgies or things that can become for us the idol itself, we're pointing to the true God here, but in fact we're kind of leading ourselves astray a bit.
I totally agree. I think that is one of the big preaching themes you could take out of this passage, is to do that more contemporary work of, there's a sense that the people here want to domesticate God. They want to make something they can see and touch and feel and that's familiar and that assures them that God is present. So in some ways their motivation is not terrible.
Yeah.
So it's not about judging people's motivation, but that there are lots of ways you could talk about that we in the church today domesticate God or create images of God where we're limiting God to a certain set of images.
Pin God down. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Instead of letting really God be God.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. The passage itself has so many other interesting things. Like, I'm interested in what you think about what Moses is doing. And just in how you were describing just before, Robert Alter's translation with this Moses lagged idea. Like, do you think in the text, because I'm thinking about what's going to happen next in the way that Moses is going to advocate for the people when God is all ready to, do the kind of thing that maybe the king in Matthew's going to do. And God changes God's mind because of Moses's action there. But I'm thinking of that and what we might want to say about Moses. But I'm curious about, is there some kind of sense of responsibility in how it's set up? Like, is Moses taking his time? Is Moses is Moses a leader of the people who is in fact just enjoying basking in the company of God, which is a wonderful thing to do, but not hearing the call to get back to the people, and they're going off on a bizarre tangent because he lags? Or am I reading too much into the translation?
I don't know, but I think that's entirely possible. And certainly that Moses is spending significant and a very biblical amount of time with God, 40 days and nights, right? There's a
biblical language for like a really long time.
So there is a sense of I wonder if it's about being sympathetic to the people. You can understand why they might feel abandoned. And it also shows their confusion again, like Moses is so closely aligned as the one that connects them to God here in perhaps a problematic way. Yeah, as soon as Moses goes away, they want to like find another image for God, another stand-in for God. You know, so you could go in all sorts of directions there about way too much dependence on the priest or minister.
Well, and a kind of sense of that we're either, I mean, even as I say that stuff about like the, are we talking about a leader who is too engrossed in their own relationship with God and not coming, like, of course, that is itself far too simplistic and binary than to think about how we can practice the sense of the presence of God in the midst of the people and in the midst of our ministries so that we are constantly back and forth in that. It's not kind of one or the other, really.
Yeah. And I think the other preaching theme out of this, it does invite us to reflect on leadership. And I don't mean here that we think of Aaron and Moses and think only of clergy, but rather leadership of church people or the church as a body. As I said before, Aaron's the pleaser who just does what is popular and is easy, and it is the wrong thing in this passage. He still goes on to be a priest, however.
And so maybe that's encouraging.
Yeah, exactly.
Just continuing the example of everybody gets something wrong at some point in today's Bible readings.
Yes, a moment of grace. But Moses, I mean, Moses here is, he stands in the breach. He literally stands between God, who wants to wipe out the people who's so angry, and the people who are just doing the wrong thing, and reminds God and the people of their mutual promises to each other. He stands there and reconciles God and the people and says, remember the covenant, and kind of shames God. I mean, we can see the honor shame ancient culture here, where he's part of his argument to God is, what will the Egyptians say that you brought your people out and then just killed them? Like, that's a bad look for a God. And God's like, oh, yeah, good point, you know. But, you know, so there's something about Moses who will go down in the history in the Hebrew Bible as the greatest prophet, as the one who stood in the breach and reminded people of their commitments to God and God's commitment to the people, and ultimately to reconcile. So there's something in that, I think, as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's that actually is a beautiful thing to sit with for the week, and not just in the role, as you say, as the role of clergy, but in the name of the church. How do we as the people of the church stand in that position and remind ourselves as a community and in conversation with God of our mutual promises.
That's great. Well, thank you, Kylie, for stepping in as co-host today. It's been great having a conversation with you.
Yeah, absolutely. My pleasure. It's wonderful. To finish up then, By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College, the Uniting Church in Australia, and produced by Adrian Jackson.
Thanks for listening. Until next time.